When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hello, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Farah Jassat.
And me, Daniel Ben-Koren.
This week we have PJ O'Rourke and Lionel Shriver in conversation about the battle for the White House. Daniel, tell us about this conversation.
So in this episode, we had the American political satirist PJ O'Rourke in conversation with the novelist Lionel Shriver, who's perhaps best known for her book, We Need to Talk About Kevin. And they were talking about the forthcoming US presidential election.
Yes, so as you say, Daniel, PJ O'Rourke is a lifelong Republican, but in 2016, he famously backed Hillary Clinton, describing her as the second worst thing that could happen to America.
And Lionel Shriver, of course, is a Democrat, but she herself is not a great fan of the candidates in the running at the moment. So they discuss the Democratic primary, the actual forthcoming electoral race itself, and the ongoing impeachment process against President Trump.
We hope you enjoy this episode. And just before we go to it, I wanted to also let you know about the other podcast series that Intelligence Squared has called How I Found My Voice. It's presented by the BBC journalist Samira Ahmed, and it's all about how prominent public figures came to find their voice, from growing up, their childhood experiences, to the defining moments in their career. In season two, which has just launched and you can listen to now, we have guests from Michael Palin to Richard Branson, Naomi Klein, the whistleblower Chris Wiley, the British MP Jess Phillips, and more. Check it out. Just search for How I Found My Voice on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Acast.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much, Hannah. It's great to be here with two fantastic writers. I feel very privileged to be sitting up here with them. So we're here tonight to try and dissect the US presidential race. November the 3rd, 2020, we will know who will be the next president of the United States. And all of that is taking place against the backdrop of an impeachment hearing. It's quite possible that President Trump will be impeached and not found guilty in the Senate and will run and may possibly win, which has never happened before, even though there have been two impeachments in the modern era. I'm not counting Andrew Johnson in 1868, but perhaps he'll come up. It's also been a very big week, apart from the impeachment hearings, in Atlanta. Last night was the fifth Democratic Party debate, so we'll be talking about that too, with the two people sitting here on the platform with me. Do please join your hands together and welcome them. So, given the polarized nature of politics in the United States, I wonder if it would help the audience if we get a steer from both of you to begin with. A short answer, I think, to begin with. Where you stand politically, Lionel Shriver.
Well, given that the United States has become so polarized, I don't fit in either camp. I regard myself as a social liberal and a fiscal conservative. I'm one of the last great fiscal conservatives left in the United States. And there is no party that represents my views. Because I really don't have any choice, I am a registered Democrat. I've certainly never made any bones about the fact that I regard the Trump presidency as one of the great, horrible accidents of in Democratic history. So, but it's, I'm constantly put into a difficult position because most of the primary contenders for the Democratic nomination are well to the left of me, especially in relation to money matters, like they want to spend a lot of it, mine. And yet, the alternative is unthinkable. So I'm especially sympathetic with people who are not at all keen on Trump, but look at the array that the Democrats now present and don't easily recognize the alternative that they're looking for.
PJ.
Well, I was a Republican, but I'm taking a few years off. I suppose really at heart I'm some sort of libertarian. You know, I kind of believe that, you know, mind your own business and keep your hands to yourself. I call these the Clinton rules. Hillary, mind your own business. Bill, keep your hands to yourself. You know, that pretty much covers my political. And I, too, regard Trump as an absolutely unmitigated disaster and a great reminder, something we always have to keep in our heads about democracy is a simple mathematical fact. 50% of people are below average in intelligence.
Felt the need for a pause there.
Can't be helped.
I'm afraid, PJ, sometimes it's 51.
Yes.
Okay, thank you both very much. So that gives us some indication of where this conversation, which direction it might go in, but not entirely. So it's very useful to have that. Let's start by talking about impeachment. I mean, this has clearly been a big red letter week, if you like. There are hearings continuing today. There was a big one yesterday with Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, giving his testimony. Let's just talk about impeachment. A lot of people seem to always be under the impression that impeachment means removal. It does not. In the context in which we are speaking, it means bringing charges in Congress that will then form the basis of a trial of a president in the Senate. The U.S. Constitution states that a president shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of the following: treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Let's just get from both of you your sense of what it is that Trump is being accused of. Because one of the things that I've been finding quite interesting is this use of language. The idea of this quid pro quo that was offered to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. I'm not entirely sure why the Democrats don't use the word bribery, which might be slightly easier for people to understand.
Or extortion.
Extortion. Yeah. So what is it that you understand that the president is being accused of?
Extortion.
And why?
I mean, I think the Democrats don't always put it in a way that's to their best advantage. And I think that expression is probably not serving them well because, at least I think finally most of the country has learned it. But... it's important that what he did wrong is made as simple as possible for the 51%. And I think one of the reasons that the Democrats have moved on this is that, at least as a story, it seems to hang together as something that could be explained to the American people that makes sense, as you're not supposed to do that. So, no, you are not supposed to use taxpayer funds to bribe someone outside the country to attack one of your political opponents. And, you know, that seems pretty easy to communicate. I think most people have got the idea. The weird thing is that about half the country, even if they do understand it, don't care. They really don't care. It's somehow... the polarization is so solidified that it takes, I mean, it would take, you know, Trump, you remember Trump said, you know, he could go out in the street and murder someone and he'd still be elected. And I'm starting to think he's right.
And in a way, a much easier narrative for the Democrats to put forward than the Mueller inquiry.
Yeah, that was foggy. I mean, one thing you have to understand about what's going on is that not only does a large percentage of Americans not care, but an even larger percentage of Americans are going, Ukraine. Now, was that the planet that made us giggle in middle school? Or is it a place? If so, in what place is that place? And then when you find out about the place, it doesn't seem like it was ever a very nice place anyway. And I honestly think the Democrats should just come out and say, we're impeaching him because he's a big sleazeball. He's a big slime ball. You can't deny that. It's all over the place. Everywhere, in every action of his that's been recorded since he came of age. And I think the Constitution is quite clear about this. It doesn't say just treason. It doesn't say just high crimes, whatever. It also says misdemeanors, and misdemeanors is just plain means. I looked it up in the dictionary. It means bad behavior. The Congress is perfectly within its rights. We do have to clear that up a little bit, I think, especially well, for Americans as well as Brits, is that an impeachment is simply he got arrested. He hasn't been tried. He hasn't even been properly arraigned. That all happens over in the Senate, and for political reasons, it's not going to happen at all. The other thing I just want to make clear is that I looked into the timing on our previous impeachments, and I did look into Andrew Johnson's as well, is just how long it takes for this thing to happen. It's almost inevitable that this will not be done, not be finished by the time the election comes along in a year. All prior experience we have on this, the Clinton impeachment, the Nixon was impeached, and the process, almost impeached, the process was halted by his resignation, and Andrew Johnson, of course, was impeached. It just takes longer. So what's going to be left there? There will be, I don't think, any verdict from the Senate, innocent or guilty. So he will be left accused by the House of Representatives. The problem with that is the House of Representatives have been accusing him of everything you can think of from the moment he became a nominee. One of the reasons that people aren't as appalled by Trump as they ought to be is the kind of criticism that Trump has taken and the kind of people from whom he has taken that criticism. They're the kind of people that a lot of Americans in the heartland of America really don't like the New York Times. And they know full well that if Trump cured cancer, the headline in the New York Times would be "Heart Disease Kills More People." So, you know, they're not only not listening, they're not listening with a will.
I wonder, though, Lionel, whether The Democrats resisted. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, was so adamant that impeachment was the last resort, that actually the Democrats should just beat the Republican candidate if it turned out to be Trump. It obviously will be. But I just wonder whether you think it was a good idea at all to even go down the road of impeachment, because she was very reluctant to do that.
I'm sympathetic with the sense that Democrats have had that they're never going to get a juicier and clearer misdemeanor, if you will. There's a lot of conviction on the part of liberals that this is a matter of the preservation of law, the preservation of democratic norms, and you can't just let him get away with this. I mean, that said, he's been getting away with so much that that's one of the reasons most of the country's not paying any attention. This just seems like business as usual.
One more.
But I also understand Nancy Pelosi's reluctance to go through with this, because the theater does play to the witch hunt narrative. And it fits a little too seamlessly into this incessant, as the Republicans perceive it, persecution of their president, and a constant sense that the, much like Brexit over here, that the Democrats have are sore losers and they want to delegitimize the election itself. So it's not just that they don't like Trump, but they believe that he was elected under a procedural cloud, and therefore he should be removed, and therefore so it fits in too well, and that's why a lot, you know, half the country is hardly even noticing. And then worse, if PJ is wrong and it does go all the way through the Senate, then the Senate, barring some truly staggering revelation in the House, is going to exonerate him, and then Trump is going to say, "Look, I didn't do anything wrong. They put me on trial, and I came out unscathed." And after all, Clinton did the same thing.
Now that's what I think actually Nancy Pelosi has been up to. You know, she is no fool as a politician, and I think she was perfectly well aware that if they impeach too soon, and that if something extraordinary didn't happen in the Senate, and I mean truly extraordinary, it would have to be like an instant Darwinian evolving of a spine. You know? simply doesn't happen over the course of a couple months.
So 20 and, senators would have to vote against Trump.
I think she wants this to be a hanging question when the election comes along. Otherwise, he's going to be going around saying, "I got exonerated. See, the Senate said I didn't do it. You know, I didn't do it. You know, I really didn't do it. I bigly didn't do it." And so I think that Nancy Pelosi was saying, yes, by all means, let's impeach him, but not too soon. Let's impeach him at a time where all the accusations against him in the House will have been aired, but the Senate hasn't got its oar in yet.
There's just a procedural problem that if Senate Republicans choose to drag out a trial, then they keep captive several candidates for the nomination on the Democratic side, because those senators would have to be present in D.C., and that would keep them from campaigning in the rest of the country.
Very good
That's
point.
That's really interesting. Yeah. But also, you said in your last comment that Clinton, the same thing, you know, that's what happened to Clinton. He was acquitted. But the difference in this case and the case with Nixon is both of those presidents were in their second terms. And in this instance, Trump is going to run for a second term. And the impeachment came in Nixon's second term and the impeachment came in Clinton's second term. And it's quite clear that the impeachment is going to make a huge impact. And is already, do you think, in the way in which the campaign is going?
I think it's making surprisingly little impact. The opinion polls haven't moved that much. Trump's support hasn't changed much. And the truth is, I think that most American voters would prefer to be the agents of his ejection. So they would find it far more gratifying, even the people who are anti-Trump, right? Well, vociferously anti-Trump, would rather kick him out themselves than have the Senate do it for them.
I very much agree. I think it's very important that he be voted out. I don't want Trump supporters saying, "Well, he was kicked out on a technicality or something." You know, some sort of oddball. He butt dialed the Prime Minister of the Ukraine, whatever. No, I want him clearly and definitely voted out by the people of the United States. That would certainly be my preference.
How do you reflect on the way in which the debate is being conducted, such as it is in the media? The fact that Trump does conduct himself pretty much entirely on Twitter or just walking out onto the White House lawn and having an impromptu press conference?
Well, there was a question that came up in the debates last night that Cory Booker answered, and I was a little frustrated that he didn't answer it. You know, that's standard. But he was asked whether, if he were president, he would continue to communicate directly with the American people via social media. The obvious alternative is to go back to making speeches on TV and and having press conferences, which is a more mediated and more formal form of communication. And we might also argue a more dignified and premeditative form of communication. And he didn't answer the question, but I think it is a good question.
Is there anything that social media hasn't made worse?
Yeah.
I mean, whose bright idea was it to put every idiot in the world in touch with every other idiot?
I mean, I do think that communicating by Twitter as the president of the United States is a huge mistake, and I would like to see it stop. It looks bad. It has a leveling effect, which is not in the interests of the office. It's just one more loser. So, you know, and yes, presidents should not be making major decisions of state at 3 a.m. on the loo.
I mean, I wonder how much impact any of this is making. You've alluded to it, both of you, a little bit, to his base. I mean, he has, I think, now nearly 67 million followers on Twitter. I expect probably quite a large proportion of that is, you know, the elite media hanging on his every word in order to be able to contest it or otherwise. But I also wonder to what extent, if we're talking about the heartland of Trump's base, you know, how much of it is shifting at all?
I think it's happening. I actually do think it's happening, because when I was covering the election in 2016, there were a lot of people who were telling me that they didn't really care all that much for Trump as a person. They were put off by him, wouldn't want him in their home. And then I would say, well, why are you sending him to Washington then? Why are you voting for him? And they said, well, that's what Washington's got coming. You know, I mean, it was, and, you know, so point taken. I mean, people were just kind of, and I'm sure that there was some of this in Brexit too. People were disappointed, upset with government. I have a libertarian theory that as government expands, it necessarily fails, because when government promises everything to everybody, everybody's going to be disappointed, and so everybody gets angry at the government. And people were sending a sort of middle finger to Washington. And some of those people, now they're not going to, when some young twerp calls them up for a phone poll or something, you know, some kind of, you know, polling institution or some East Coast media elite queries them at Walmart, they're not going to come around and say, yeah, I've had it with him. But in private, I am hearing, I live way out in the country and I know lots of people who voted for Trump, and in private I'm hearing, well, you know, the place seemed to be run like by clowns, so we've sent a clown down to head it up, you know. And it didn't work out all that well. I'm not so sure we're going to do that. So I think his base support is slipping, but I think it's a very hard thing for polling institutions to measure.
I can't emphasize how important it is whom the Democrats nominate, because the people we're talking about, who maybe either supported Trump but are disillusioned or are a little on the fence in swing states, their views are very moderate. They're exactly the kind of people that that debate last night was not speaking to. They don't actually need that much. They need a candidate who is competent and safe and relatively moderate, someone who is going to make everyone feel normal again. And that should be easy. In other words, winning this election should be a cinch. Yet we can't, with the current crop, trust the Democrats to nominate that competent, moderate person that all those people who will make the difference as to whether or not Trump has another 4 years to destroy the whole world wins again. And it really is staggering to me that the Democratic powers that be didn't see that from the start, and really rally round a moderate candidate. You know, and I think we're sliding
Let's talk about what happened last night. You know, there were 10. There are now 10 who appeared in the debate last night. And I think in the next primary debate, 6 have qualified. Who's your preferred candidate of the ones who appeared last night?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I'm like a lot of moderate Democratic voters in that by default I end up supporting Biden without any enthusiasm. I mean, I'm a walking cliche. I don't have any faith in Biden to go the distance. His performance last night was described by a number of commentators as better than usual. Oh, my God. And, you know, weirdly, he has a lot of the same problems that Trump does. He can't finish a sentence. He interrupts himself. He has this freakish habit of being in the middle of the sentence and then saying, anyway. It's like a little brain fart. And, you know, and I will share, I believe that Trump is suffering from serious cognitive decline. It's not just that he's evil, it's that he's increasingly a little bit out of his mind, and like a lot. And actually, Biden has some of these same qualities. So he just keeps up with the gaffes, and it's become a bit of a joke, all the things he gets wrong, and he keeps referring to 1970 as if it were yesterday. I don't think he's going to make it. So, I mean, then there's...
When you say you don't think he's going
to
make it...
I don't think he's going to make it to...
The bathroom.
Now, that was mean.
I'm 72 years old, and I get to say things like that. You know? Because I look at the poor guy, and I think everything you said, and I think, yeah, ooh, me too. You know, I mean, I came into this room. Why? Anyway, as I was saying, is that I know personally, 72 years old, I'm moderately fit, you know, not quite as clean living as Joe is, but, you know, I'm all right for my age. And I think, you know, day after day, America's an immense country, and day after day after day of bussing around, having 6 pancake breakfasts and 7 spaghetti dinners, you know, with various volunteer groups and so on, and giving the same gibberish speech over and over again and not quite remembering what part of it I'm in, you know, and where it's supposed to end or begin, for that matter, you know. You know, I'd be dead in a month, you know, and I fear he may be too, you know.
Is he your preferred candidate?
Well, no. I mean, I've been saying for quite a while that the Democrats are operating on the premise that nobody can lose to Trump, and by God, they're going to find that nobody. I don't really have a preferred Democratic candidate, but anybody sane will do. You know, anybody sane and, you know, pretty much has it together and whose ideas aren't completely crackpot and who doesn't want to spend gajillions of dollars. Any sort of regular old Democrat would be fine with me.
Well, I wish he'd entered the race much earlier, because if I were picking to begin with, to the best person to run against Trump, and the one candidate that I think Trump would dread most is Michael Bloomberg. Yeah. Now, he came in awfully late. He's at least going to miss the first 3 primaries. He's not in any of these debates, and there have now been 5 of them, and that's a huge amount of free publicity. You know, so
and Mike would be good at that.
And he
too.
Would be good, but you know, really he's a businessman, but he's a successful businessman.
Yes.
But are we clear that
and
he
he's
definitely
not fat.
Will run?
No, we, it's not.
It's
clear
not
that,
clear that he will definitely run. Mike, I mean, he's talking about entering the race at Super Tuesday, so missing Iowa, missing New Hampshire.
I actually know Mike. I, not not very, very well, but I know him fairly well, and I've spent a fair amount of time talking to him. He he has people. He has people who really know stuff, people who can count to 11 without taking a sock off, all sorts of really smart people. He considered getting in 2016, and he told me the reason he didn't do it is he put his people on this, and they did all the analysis, and it seemed that his entrance into the race, as in that case as a third-party candidate, would have helped Hillary lose. Yeah. Of course, she managed that on her own, as it turned out. But besides coming in late with Mike being a problem, is he's also very New York. And he's not as well known. I mean, his business is, people think he's a TV station. They don't know he's a person, you know. He's not. Those of us who lived in New York while he was mayor, and he was a very good mayor, we all say, hey, there's the guy, wonderful technocrat, you know, trustworthy, you know, moderate in his spending, a little bit around the bend on things like giant bottles of soda and so on, you know. But you know, we'll forgive him that easily for cleaning up the streets and cutting down the crime and generally making the place run considerably better than New York had in human memory. We know who he is. We think he's great, but he's not that well known outside the group of people who are New York or New York adjacent or frequent New York visitors.
Yeah, but the people we're talking about, right? Those people in the middle who are capable of going either way.
Mm-hmm. He'd be great.
They'd go for Bloomberg. They don't know him now, but if he became the nominee, know him.
The problem is this lateness, you know,
may be fatal.
I just fear that Mike's going to do the numbers on this and determine, calculate that it is fatal and that he moved too slow.
And given what you've both said about Joe Biden, is there anyone in that current group, not Mike Bloomberg, who might get the nomination?
Pete?
I mean,
Mayor Pete from Indiana.
The Buttigieg story is an interesting one. He seems to be pulling out in front, astonishingly.
But only in Iowa and New Hampshire. I mean, he doesn't poll well with the African-American vote at all, for instance, which is a really big problem.
And I'm going to say something controversial.
Oh, good.
Okay.
For once. I think one of the reasons he doesn't poll as well as some candidates is not just that he's white, obviously, but I think that the black community in the United States is more conservative on the LGBTQ front and are less keen on his being gay. And I think there, it is, if we're really talking about nominating him, it's... It would be nice to believe that the United States is not only now pro-gay marriage, but perfectly happy to have a gay president. But it's worth asking the question. I'm not so sure.
He was dismissed in that debate last night as being a local official.
And, you know, well, I mean, it's not just that he's gay. It's also that he is a mayor of a tiny town.
He's a mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana. South Bend, very important place in America until 1963 when the Studebaker plant closed. So, yeah, that's a big problem. But I do think that, I agree with Lionel. I think the gay thing is a little bit of a problem, and it's not a problem we're going to be able to get honest polling about.
No, no one's going to
Nobody's going to answer that question and say, yeah, no, I can't vote for him, you know, because it's just too strange. I mean, I don't like that stuff, you know. Nobody's going to say that to a poll.
Just to lay it on the table, I think that people want to associate a president with strength and power, and there is this little sometimes subconscious association with men, gay men, with weakness, and I think that's a political problem.
Alexander the Great would have begged to differ, but. But no, nonetheless, I take your, I mean, you know, just as a man, as you, and it's just one of those things. Well, I think Americans have kind of given up telling the truth to any kind of polling outfit anyway. But I mean, that's certainly not a question you're going to get an honest answer to.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Let's just talk briefly about Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, because we haven't really got to the heart of the raison d'etre of the Democratic Party. Should it be, in order for it to challenge a candidate like Trump, should it be about the prosperity of all Americans, or should it be about redistributing wealth, which is the kind of top line that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren put out? Lionel.
Well, I mean, I think either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders would be a catastrophic nominee, and especially Elizabeth Warren is exactly whom Trump wants to run against, right? He would regard this as, you know, Hillary too. And I think he could very easily beat her. She's the last person I want to be nominated. And, you know, they both got similar problems. They're promising free everything. You know that use of free. And Warren, in particular, claims that this is not going to raise taxes on the middle class at all. And by the way, this is where we've got an intersection with the UK right now, because you've got Corbyn. Free everything, even free broadband. And yet it's not going to cost you anything. Uh-huh, and I've got a bridge in Brooklyn that's going cheap. And also, Warren has this notion that you can the entire country can live off of the proceeds of the top 1%. And this is what the left has been selling for some time now.
For a couple centuries.
Is, Corbyn does the same thing, that all you have to do is soak the rich and everything will be free for everyone else. And it just doesn't add up statistically.
It really doesn't, Lana. I actually went and did the math on this. And if you took all of the income of the top 10% of earners in America, if you took all their income, it would fund the federal government for exactly 1 year. And then the next year when you came back, would that top 10% be there? I don't think so. I think they'd be in the Cayman Islands or someplace, and it just wouldn't, you know. Then if you say, oh, well, you know, wealth is not just what one earns, it's what one's worth. And so I did my best to figure out sort of net worth of the top 10% of Americans. If you took all the net worth of the top 10% of Americans, it would fund the federal government for not quite the 4 years that it would take you to get reelected to your second term. And then it's gone. It's gone. You can't go back and get more. You know, and that is the problem.
And there's also there is a philosophical and political question Mark, over the whole idea of a wealth tax. I know it's frustrating to see people, some of them not even all that bright or capable, somehow amassing enormous fortunes. But the principle of the government just coming in and taking it because it can. I mean, government does that to a degree already. But this is money that you have somehow miraculously got through the tax system and out the other side, and you still have something. And the government says, well, we're going to punish you for actually keeping anything. It's creepy, all right? Now, I'm not quite sure what the answer is to the inequality situation, and but I find the idea of the wealth tax disturbing, and it's especially disturbing because, you know, there's a long history of Democrats in particular running on platforms that say, you know, they want to tax the millionaires and billionaires. And then when it comes down to designing practicable policy, it pertains to anybody who makes over, you know, $200,000. I mean, there's this massive bracket creep, so that if you bring in the idea of a wealth tax, you just watch it start to hit anybody who's saved anything.
Okay, let's move on to the future of the Republican Party, because clearly...
This is going to be the shortest segment.
Clearly, utterly transformed by the election of President Trump. Let's start with you, PJ. Where do you think it stands at the moment? Because it's quite clear in the impeachment hearings that there are one or two Republicans who have come out and expressed disquiet about the way in which the president behaves.
Mild
disquiet, not much more.
I'm not sure I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
I just wonder if you would give us an assessment of the... how would you characterize
It's going to destroy the Republican Party, but it won't really matter because, as I explained, and the party doesn't really exist anyway, so you can't really destroy something that isn't there. I mean, what we have in the United States, rather than political parties in the sense that most of the world has political parties that you join, you carry a card, you can get kicked out of, you pay dues to, ours are just these big sloppy tendencies. We've got a big sort of sloppy tendency to think, oh, the government should do a little more to help do this, that, and the other thing. And another big sloppy tendency, often present in the same person, going, wait a minute, what's that going to cost? You know? And so it's really Venn diagrams. Sometimes there's a great deal, as there was in the 50s, there's a great deal of overlap. Sometimes there's like an 80% overlap. Sometimes, as at the moment, the two circles of the Venn diagram barely touch each other. So the Republicans will go down in flames, as they have many, many times before. And then the Democrats will screw it up, may take 4 years, may take eight, and the Republicans will pop back up again, and we'll be back at it.
How much, though, do you think the Republican Party is even talking or considering the demographic shift that's taking place in America, that increasingly it's becoming non-white in many states, Hispanic-speaking, and so on? To what extent are they even informed by that on a structural level?
None. I mean, first place, there is no sort of central... This is like a starfish or something. It doesn't have a central nervous system with a brain at the middle of it. You know, I mean, it's just a big blobby thing. So they're not really considering that. And if an individual Republican does consider the question of America becoming less Caucasian, more diverse, younger, he'll go, they'll grow out of it. You know, I mean, one of these days they'll wake up at 40, realize what their tax bill is, and that they got to send their kids to private school because the public school stinks, you know, and nobody's fixed the potholes, and we'll have them, you know, no matter what color they are, no matter what preference they may have or what their last name is.
What do you think, Lionel? I mean,
I'd be surprised if PJ is entirely correct. I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who, certainly in office, who are watching the nature of their constituencies change, and I bet they're thinking about it, although they're not in control of that. you know, there's a cynical side to Democratic enthusiasm for immigration in the same way that Tony Blair, you know, opened the floodgates with the presumption that everyone would vote for Labor. And Democrats make exactly the same presumption. I am hopeful that the Hispanic community will become sufficiently American that their votes become up for grabs. I mean, actually, the cultural tendencies among recent Hispanic immigrants are pretty conservative and economically conservative. So, yes, they will be potentially open to bread and butter and, you know, high taxation issues. I don't think the Democrats right now are licking their lips. They watch a state like Virginia turn blue, which is staggering. And it's mostly because of Hispanic immigration. But I don't think they can count on those votes indefinitely. And I hope they can't, because I don't want to live in a one-party state. I don't want the United States to lose the capacity to go back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans, or whatever might replace the Republicans. I think that's an important aspect of having a healthy polity. I may technically be a Democrat, but I have a big foot outside, and I don't trust that party, especially if you put them fatuously and complacently and indefinitely in power.
What is it, do you think? Is there a figure inside the Republican Party at the moment that you think could emerge if Trump does win in 2020, who can reinvent or refine those values that you talk about?
I haven't seen him or her or whatever pronoun is preferred. Have you?
No, and, you know, you were mentioning this in the green room. I do find it staggering that a country that is now pushing 400 million people comes up with such rubbish candidates. I mean, why isn't there someone on the Republican side? Why can't we name 5 or 10 of them who are waiting in the wings? That and instead, the congressional Republican delegation has contaminated itself with Trump in a way that really knocks all of them out.
Let's open up the questions to the floor. Yeah.
Hello. What do you think of Nikki Haley's chances coming through to revive the Republican Party?
I actually wish I'd thought of that, as a matter of fact. now that you remind me, I might have said maybe Nikki Haley will be the rallying. I think pretty good. I mean, she has a good record. She's a very effective politician. She has sort of feeling of kind of strength and positive energy about her. Yeah, she could very well. And she's, you know, by politician age standards, she's quite young too. So there's, you know, there'd be time for her to be maybe the phoenix rising from the ashes.
I never understood why she resigned.
I don't know.
To earn money.
To earn money.
Oh, that. Earn money. Yeah.
Let's just go here first, if you could. Can we get a microphone here, and then we'll go to the back over there.
Thank you. I'm wondering why the three of you in the time you've been speaking haven't mentioned the role that the state of the economy will play in the next election. Because I heard Frank Luntz, the Republican strategist, make the comment that the last time an incumbent president lost with economic numbers that looked like this was never. Is this election going to be different somehow?
I mean, the economy certainly helps Trump, although I am not convinced that he can take much credit for it. This is one of those weird... This happens all the time, that presidents get credit for good economies, and then they also unfairly get the blame for bad ones. And often, you know, the economy is its own animal and has its ebb and flow, and often is responding to the degree that government has any effect on it. It's often responding in a delayed fashion. So decisions that Obama made will still be carrying forward and influence the atmosphere.
I would give a little different explanation of that. I think the American economy has been bubbling along pretty well for such a long time now that it's become sort of invisible. When the economy is very volatile, popping up and down constantly, it becomes a strong political issue. In this case, it's the candidate and the incumbent who have been popping up and down with great volatility while the American economy has just been sort of steaming along. And I think people have begun to take it a little for granted. But you're right. You're right. We should have discussed that a bit, because it is helpful to an incumbent, even as odd an incumbent as Trump is going to be helped by a good economy.
Number two just here, and then we'll go to one over there.
Hi, it's just a follow-up question on your comments about Harris. Surely it's a good thing that more Democratic nominees are making racial justice a central part of their platform. If kind of the election of Trump has shown anything, it's that white supremacy is going strong.
I think there's too much focus on racial justice among the primary candidates. Primary candidates. I just think that at this point in time, we really need to start using very inclusive rhetoric. Because the country has become so incredibly divided. And, you know, the last few years, and it's not just Trump, but the last few years, just culturally, the United States has, especially on the left, has become consumed with race. So it's not as if, oh, we've never talked about this before. If you take a look at the New York Times, everything is looked at through the prism of race, which is historically astonishing because, I mean, that would have made sense in the 1950s and 60s. But things are really better than they've ever been before in terms of equality of opportunity. And yet, and ironically, it's especially white liberals are now obsessed with it. And I think it backfires. And, this is actually in comparison to minorities who are not nearly as consumed with skin color and racial injustice. Even approaching things like misuse of power by the police. And you know what? That's not just a black problem. The police are shooting everybody. And if you look at the New York Times did published some rather embarrassed results during the thick of Black Lives Matter, and looked at all of the police caused fatalities going back, I don't remember how many years, but it was a big section, and they didn't find any racial disparity at all, which is not what they wanted to find. That doesn't mean that the police are good and all of these homicides are justified. It just means that they are abusive of everybody.
But on the issue of white supremacy, I mean,
and not held accountable.
Isn't it an issue? What you were talking about earlier in that answer to about Kamala Harris, that it's about tone and it's about how you talk about those arguments, because it's certainly true that President Trump has emboldened white supremacists to think that it's fine for them to say the things that they say because of his ambivalence on the subject, and that's just being very generous to him.
I believe that the actual number of white supremacists in the United States is still very small. I think that there is a kind of need on the left for these people, and in some ways they have been created. The United States has had a fringe movement of racial lunatics forever. Okay, you know, the KKK, etc. But for the most part, in recent times, it has been a tiny number of people. Now, it's true that Trump has emboldened them to become more visible and more vocal, but I have not seen any studies that document that there is some kind of huge escalation of actual white supremacy. One of the problems is that the term has become so degraded that we now just use it to mean racist or someone, or for that matter, just somebody I don't like. It is illiberally distributed everywhere, but it used to mean something. It used to mean an actual ideology that believed that white people were superior to other races. And the test of a real white supremacist is when you call them a white supremacist, they say, hell yeah. And they're proud of it.
I mean, I just want to pursue it just a little bit more, because I am interested in the influence and the of Steve Bannon. And there's also the Southern Law Poverty Group just did this huge investigation into Steve Mnuchin and the emails that he's been sending for years and years. And it is about sensibility rather than a structural group of people who call themselves white supremacists who march up and down the streets of the United States. It's about sensibility existing inside the corridors of power, isn't it?
Well, let's thank God for that, because let us always choose disorganized and marginal evil over well-organized evil. You know, we really don't. And to Lionel's point is that there is an element in the United States of really repulsive politics. You could hardly have a country of almost 400 million and not have that element. Our Ku Klux Klan, they're morons for the most part. I mean, they're out there and they can't even.
They have such poor dress sense.
They're in floral sheets. You know, they're in floral sheets with fitted corners. You know, I mean, it's just it's not working for them. You know? Yeah, it really isn't.
Let's take another question. His hand just over there. Can we get a microphone to?
So on this point of the importance of having two strong parties, you both made comments about how that gave the benefit of a potentially decent, good conversation on both sides. Is there anything you see in the Republican Party right now that indicates they're capable of that? Or are they suddenly all going to have this miraculous growth of a spine when Trump's finally gone, whether that's November next year or 4 years hence?
Well, they have to lose. You know, that's the only thing that's going to clean up and clear out the Republican Party. They have to lose the White House. They probably have to lose Congress, and I hope they do.
Actually,
and they will completely destroy themselves if they have another 4 years of Trump.
Yeah.
But I have this recurrent image of Donald Trump being hauled out in a straitjacket from the White House by security.
If we're lucky. If we're lucky.
I think we've got time for one final question.
Yes, this session is called the Battle for the White House. And most battles are won because of a successful strategy or plan. I'm interested to know what each of you would say is your three-point plan. You've asked for pithy questions. I hope it's okay if I ask pithy answers. But your three-point plan for beating him. And in particular, one of the things I'd like to hear is how we communicate, beat him in communication terms. It's very easy to dismiss Trump as an idiot, as somebody who's corrupt. But one of the things that he seems to have done, or at least the team around him seems to have done, is to have cut through and communicated to the 51%. How do we beat in communication terms somebody who seems to have an ability to do that? In the same way that take back control was a motto that was irritating for those of us who were on the Remain side of the debate, it captured something, it synthesized something, and it resonated. How do we beat Trump in communication terms, and what is your three-point plan for doing so?
Does it have to be numbered? You don't ask much.
Numbered and in alphabetical order.
Look, I would just say generally that what the Democrats have to do is to stop living in their little echo chamber and trying to out-liberal each other. The most catastrophic point in the primary campaign came in the first debate when the entire stageful was asked whether or not they would give free health care to illegal immigrants, and they all raised their hands. It was like, yes, I want Trump to have four more years. The problem is that Democrats are constantly talking to the far left of the party. Those are the people they're hanging out with. Those are the people who come to their rallies. But these are not the people who are going to make the difference as to whether or not Trump gets four more years. So I would like to see that whoever gets the nomination tack much toward more toward the center. Do not promote an open borders policy, which any number of the current candidates are doing. Have appreciation for the essentially moderate nature of the average Democratic voter.
And I would say that they got to listen. They have to listen to what goes on in ordinary people's lives. I mean, I was talking earlier about people sort of giving the middle finger to Washington by voting for Trump. And the best example of that I came across when I was covering the campaign was I got to know and got to like very much this fellow in New Hampshire. He had a garage, a body shop, and a gas station sort of operation. And he was doing pretty well for himself. And he was really a firm Trump supporter. And I asked him, you know, basically why. I said, you know, do you like the guy? He said, I don't like the guy. You know, I don't like the guy. I wouldn't want him around. But I said, but, you know, so what's going on here? And he said, well, you know, I have three gasoline tanks that have been in the ground for too long. They're at the end of their safe existence. They need to be replaced. I can't get the local or the state or the federal permits to pull these tanks out. I can't get the local or the state or the federal permits to put new tanks back in. He said, our business is doing really well. I can afford Obamacare, and I provide health care for my employees. But he said, it never seems to occur to those guys down in Washington that every time they have a bright idea, 50 pages of paper crap land on my desk to be filled out. He said, I don't have a legal department. I don't have a health and human services department. I don't have a personnel department. It's me and my wife, and I'm a mechanic, you know. And then I've got this junkyard out back, and it's been a junkyard since the 1920s, and now it's got an endangered newt in it, you know. And I said, okay, fine, but how does sending a maniac to Washington fix this? And that's when he said, that's what they got coming, you know. So a little listening to guys like that would be helpful. You know?
Well, that was a longish but wonderful nutshell of why Trump was voted. I think we should convene again on November the 4th when we know the result of the 2020 election. For now, though, thank you very much, sir, for your question. And thank you all for your questions.